Our next speaker is actually here in the flesh. Robert Buxbaum is here from Mass Audubon in Wenham, Massachusetts, and he'll be speaking about setting priorities for eelgrass conservation and restoration.
All right, I've been asked to talk about setting priorities for eelgrass conservation and restoration. Sort of addressing the old question, you know, how valuable are eelgrasses in a general sense from a conservation perspective? Can we distinguish between seagrass beds of different types as to their value? There we go. And I think this is just a review of what Fred and others have already covered, so I don't need to spend the time about it, but some of that values of eelgrass as a habitat, as we just heard, nursery area, feeding area for many waterfowl, and consumed directly or goes into detritus food chains, and then filter, nutrient filter, we've heard about that, and sediment stabilizer. So some of this talk is going to be based on the Massachusetts Oceans the development of a Massachusetts Ocean Plan. I was one of the members of the Habitat Working Group where we were trying to set aside values or evaluate different habitats in order to sort of prioritize habitats for conservation. A number of other people are here. Phil was on the panel, Jay, I think you were on that, and Kate, Glenn, Morrison. So they'll be all over me if I misspeak, misrepresent this. So anyway, the Ocean Management Plan for Massachusetts, among other things, it gives a values, biodiversity, ecosystem health, and the mission of this particular working group that I was on was to identify and protect special, sensitive, or unique estuarine and marine life and habitats. And the scope is Massachusetts coastal waters from a half a kilometer out to the seaward boundary, which isn't always 3 miles in Massachusetts for reasons we don't need to get into. So what this means is a lot of the seagrass beds that are inshore of that half a kilometer boundary don't fall under this this exercise. So the committee, which is chaired by Bruce Carlisle of CZM, took three approaches to prioritizing habitats. One was strictly a regulatory approach. There are areas that already have legal protection. These might include endangered species, estimated habitat for endangered species, or areas protected as special aquatic sites like eelgrasses. A biotic approach, in which we evaluated habitats considered important for life stages of different species. And then an abiotic approach, where you looked at physical parameters and try to tease out from those, is another approach, what might be special habitats or habitats requiring protection. So just to briefly go through the track one, the legally protected areas. These are a variety of areas. For example, this is all Massachusetts coastal waters, so state waters, and you can see all of Cape Cod Bay, even though it's more than 3 miles from the shoreline, is considered Massachusetts waters. There's this big suspicious hole in the middle of Nantucket Sound. And these are all areas that have some kind of legal protection. A lot of this big area of Cape Cod Bay is habitat for right whales. Now, seagrasses, the legal protection in Massachusetts is under the Massachusetts Wetland Protection Act, and as a special aquatic site under Federal Clean Water Act. I'm not sure, and Phil would know more about if there are other state regulations and other.
You're stealing my body.
Anyway, so doesn't show up very well, but these are the seagrass beds in sort of this dark color, and this is taken from Charlie Costello's data layer that he presented earlier. That would be outside that half kilometer boundary. These are seagrass beds here along this way. There's one in Nahant that Phil's very familiar with. He did his thesis there. So which taxa or habitats did we look at in order to make this overall estimation of valuable habitat? And what I want to talk about is how did seagrasses kind of fit into that? To a large extent, it's driven by the presence of data, charismatic species like whales. We know there's information on whales. Charismatic species like seagrasses, we know there's information on that. Fish, commercial species, certainly there's information. We had a limited time for analysis. This is a political process, so we had to come up with a report. that then could be turned into a management plan, which is the whole goal just by another group. And then we acknowledge data gaps, and one of the things is we know a fair amount from, particularly from Charlie DeStello's mapping about seagrasses, less about kelp habitat, which may be, which we assume have similar functions as eelgrass. We don't know distributions of marine invertebrates, and there's a limitation of what we know about non-commercial fish. So criteria used for comparing different types of habitats, and this is right from the report, and these were scores that they were given. So the scores of a three, this was kind of a ranking process. So a type of habitat that was given a three would be up for a higher level of protection in sort of our aerial surveys than a two or a one, but certainly more than a zero. And number three, and you can see that they sort of, using this biological criteria, it has to do with the rarity of the habitat, the sensitivity of the habitat, whether there's endangered species there, and whether there are no limited number of other areas that provide similar functions. And then number two would be exceptional and somewhat unique habitats, habitats with high vulnerability. They might be more widespread than a habitat that was ranked as a number three. And then number one would be important habitats, which are even more widespread. You see, there's a lot of professional judgment involved. I think any of you who've done this kind of exercise know that there's not a lot of data you can base this on. In fact, the fisheries data was very good because they have the most abundant surveys, and certainly seagrass data in Massachusetts, at least in terms of knowing the distribution, was great. But for most other things, we're working with a lot of professional judgment. So here are some of the habitats, and just to kind of hit the seagrass, seagrass is about, and widgeon grass lumped together or rated as a ranked number two in terms of the sensitivity of the habitat. And you can see that all the ones ranked number three are those dealing with federally listed endangered, so the habitats are federally listed and endangered species. So that's where sort of seagrasses came out in that, just that particular exercise. And then number ones would be those types of habitats, which are special and unique to Massachusetts coast, but which are pretty more widespread. So what happens is you take all these ratings and you integrate them into a GIS map, and this is the GIS people on the committee were involved in this from MassGIS, and it created an artificial scale, so the overlapping of different habitats, and I'll show you an overlap map, they had these different characteristics that were ranked, and you create an artificial scale from 0 to 16, and then classify that as low, medium, high, or critical habitat types. And this is the integrated ranking of those biotic criteria, and the red areas are those that were listed as particularly higher priority in terms of habitat value, overlapping the criteria. These are based on grid blocks of 250 meters square, so each square was given a habit, was given an evaluation from that 0 to 16, and then evaluated, and the total score what came out as critical being red, orange being high priority, and medium, yellow, and green was low priority. Glad to see no part of the Massachusetts coast didn't have at least low priority. And these were the seagrass dominated areas. I thought that would be interesting to see where they fit in. Here was Phil's Nahant bed. And you can see there's a little bit of yellow in the midst of all that green. That's the seagrass bringing it up to a higher level of protection. Here's, I'll talk, this is Billings Gate Shoal, one of the larger seagrass beds in Massachusetts right off there. Here's off of East, off of Monomoy Island. And there's this little bit trailing out from Martha's Vineyard from Edgartown. So seagrass has kind of increased, overlapping with some of the other values that we were looking at, had those areas stand out. So seagrass in relation to other, what this just showed is seagrass in relation to other habitats and how it was integrated into this ocean management plan. Now within habitat types are some habitats of higher priority than others. And you might say this fits into the terrestrial model of exemplary natural communities. Are some areas, this is probably a TNC concept, and used by heritage programs, are there exemplary natural communities? Are some seagrass beds or salt marshes more exemplary than others. And the options for evaluating within a habitat is simply not to evaluate, but simply do presence-absence. So if the seagrass is present, it gets the same value, or you could do some kind of a ranking system. And this was done very well by the fisheries people, where they could rank the value of a certain area, each of those grid blocks, based on presence or absence of fish. They came up low, medium, and high. For our exercise, we didn't do anything with seagrass, basically any habitat that had seagrass in it, any one of those grid blocks that had seagrass in it was given the same ranking system. But the question is, could you rank according to that? And so what the rest of this talk is going to be dealing with is sort of concept of landscapes of seagrasses and how you evaluate the habitat value of seagrasses based on the landscape. And there's been a number of people, particularly Mark Fonseca, Susan Bell, among others, who have been sort of investigating this question of different morphologies of seagrass beds and how that might affect the faunal distribution. So you have an area such as here. And some of this work is going to be done on Thalassia, the turtle grass beds. It's not all Zostera, because that's what's out there in the literature. This would be almost a complete 100% cover. These are different areas of patchiness of seagrass beds. And in an earlier paper from the 1998, they suggest that a threshold of 59% cover of seagrass, below which there would be a functional effects. Doesn't mean that there's no value below 59%, that would be the wrong way to interpret that, but simply that it would be a different sort of value when you have a patchier seagrass bed, such as here, and you compare that. So what landscape features of eelgrass might influence these values? A number of these were actually alluded to in the last presentation. Size of the bed, density of plants, patchiness, fragmentation, proximity of other habitats. How does the seagrass fit into that landscape, the depth? Cover seagrass is a response to this, some of the stuff Fred went over earlier today, but cover is a response is an internal regulation of cover of seagrasses by rhizome elongation rates and branching, Fred went through, which is a response to sediment type, light levels, and nutrients. External factors affect the distribution of seagrasses, wave and current exposure, current speed, water depth, herbivory, and then human disturbances are all affecting that seagrass landscape and subsequently how it might affect fauna that depend on them. This is from Charlie Costello's surveys. This is actually Billingsgate Shoal area on Wellesley, which is one of the most naturally dynamic seagrass areas in the state. This looks like sort of a reddish-orange color here was what was present in 1995, and the green, the two shades of green are what's present in 95 and 01 or 01 only. And you can see that it's changed quite a lot. There's a big decline. It's also an area, a very dynamic part of the coast. There used to be a town here on an island with a post office and a tavern, a fishing station, and that's no longer there, so one could sort of see if the human structures couldn't survive the changes there, then one would expect at least dynamic action among the seagrass community. But the question is, what part of that is the seagrass bed? How do we interpret that? So, and then there's also the issue of scale when you're addressing this kind of a question. Many of the studies that are done looking at these kinds of questions of shape of beds or landscape characteristics focus on more sedentary organisms. They're easier to measure and harder to look at larger scale, it's more motile organisms. So landscape features, patch size, fragmentation on a large scale, edge effects, proximity. On a small scale, local scale, can be plant density, and this has sometimes been studied with artificial seagrass units, so people can actually do manipulative experiments and really compare different structures, size, and densities of seagrass beds. A lot of our thinking about how patch sizes affect organisms is colored by our sort of terrestrial model and the theory of island biogeography, which most of us learned about in Ecology 101, where, and these are some of the basic precepts And some of the literature on seagrasses sort of address this and say, well, does this pertain to a marine habitat? So typically larger islands will contain more species. And when we're talking islands here, we're thinking of seagrasses, think patches, larger patches of seagrass. Will that contain more species than smaller ones? Will more patches that are closer to other patches have more species than distant ones? Will those with a more diverse structure, which could be a mixture of seagrass, bare spots, seagrass of different sizes and densities, and then the notion of extinctions and immigrations, or there's some kind of equilibrium that you achieve in patches. So applied to seagrasses, one might predict that the diversity and abundance of species within a eelgrass meadow would follow the patterns of islands. Larger patches and more connected patches should have more species, and more complex seagrass meadows should have more species. And the complexity would be a function of plant density, mosaic of habitat types. So a number of studies have been done. I'm picking a lot of this from a review by Bostrom, Jackson, and Simonstad in this paper, which reviews a lot of the studies. It was really nice. I thought I would have to do, when Phil and Hillary asked me to do this talk, I thought I'd have to go through the literature, and then somehow barged upon this paper, and somebody had already done the review. So that was kind of handy. But taxa and different studies reviewed that to see the effects of these landscape functions. These are the response variables of those taxa. There, people looked at different studies, biomass, mortality, reproduction, growth, predation, number of species. So the impact of landscape, these landscape parameters on these particular functions. There's only two studies that have looked at diversity, at least cited in this review, that have looked at diversity versus patch size, which is sort of the classic MacArthur-Wilson model. And one of them showed a positive effect on invertebrate taxa. Larger patches had more taxa. But the second study, looking specifically at amphipods, found no relationship. And that's kind of the message I'm going to give you here. I'll tell you the punchline is the data are very messy, and there's no clear patterns of any of these landscape functions with species diversity or abundance or any of those parameters. And in a summary is in Bostrom et al., they look at the number of studies in which there is open bars or significant effects or non-significant effects. Now, the significant effects can be in either direction. So paracaras or amphipods become the largest group of amphipods, decapods, crabs and shrimp and lobsters, fish, and bivalves. Only bivalves seem to show more positive association with larger seagrass sizes, and that's believed to be the result of lower mortality in the larger patches. And that's just simply looking at patch size. This is looking at experiments with artificial seagrass units. And here, the data, once again, are equivocal, 7 significant effects, 7 non-significant effects, so no effect of the size, in this case it's size of the artificial seagrass unit patch, decapods. In some cases it's positive, in some cases it's negative, so just because it's significant doesn't mean there's a positive association with larger patches. And bivalves are all non-significant relationship. Edge effects. Edge and fragmentation are slightly different parameters. Edge is sort of the amount of boundary or perimeter, whereas fragmentation, at least from the landscape perspective, is a sort of a process of fragmentation. It's more a temporal effect. But anyway, looking at edges, you do see a significantly higher density of paracarids at edges of seagrass meadows in most studies, as reflected here with these open bars being significant effects. Most of them are positive. So one could say that paracarids are more likely to be found along the edges of seagrass beds, according to this. And bivalves, this is an interesting effect, which makes sense. Bivalves often show greater growth rates, but higher mortality with increasing edge. And meaning that if you're located along the edge of a seagrass bed, you're in a better position to get food because of current flow, but you're also more likely to get chewed upon by a predator. So the conclusion from these studies are a large variation in responses of different groups of organisms to landscape features. Prep and serve edges may be related to decrease in water movement at those points. There may be a passive transport, and that's why you see some of these things along seem to have show a preference for edges. Spaces between patches may foster movement of predators. So a lot of times when you talk about the value of a seagrass complex, 2 minutes, I think it'll hit. It has to do with what organism you're really referring to. Are you concerned about bivalves? Are you concerned about fish? Because they'll respond differently. And then number four, gets to the point I just mentioned in the previous slide, that habitat choices may be a trade-off between foraging fish that are higher and less dense, more patchy beds, and susceptibility to predation. And then finally, the areas adjacent to seagrass patches support more species than those where no beds are present. And then this is just my attempt at, I should tell you that my three-year-old kid did this, but it really wasn't me. I haven't figured out how to do those nice cartoons. But anyway, this gives you the same idea, the patch size effect on settling of larvae. This represents water movement. And you see the greater sort of edge area means you may get a greater amount of settling and a greater amount of food transport availability in these smaller patches. Same time, fish that are hanging out on either side can go either way, can move between these areas to predate on smaller prey. So anyway, there's also been some work on nursery area. There's a paper by Beck, Bioscience et al., which looked at variation in nursery role of seagrasses within an estuary and came up with these kind of factors, that the variation in the nursery value of a seagrass bed depends on larval supply, structural complexity, predation, competition for food. Within the landscape, the spatial pattern could affect the role of the nursery area. And they particularly point out stress this location relative to other key habitats. So an area that's perhaps near a marsh or another valuable nursery habitat may have a higher value, or an area just immediately downstream, if it's in a river and there's an anadromous fish coming downstream, could be a higher, have more function in that regard. So they look at sources of variation in nursery value, seagrasses, position within the estuary, location of adult habitat. There are also possibly latitudinal gradients in nursery value, which in the literature, and these are sort of open questions, and then structural complexity of the bed. I'm getting lost there. One of the questions is that we talked about on this ocean management committee is how do we, and we didn't deal with, and the whole thing is still a work in progress, in fact the report is still a draft report, is how to deal with potential habitat. You know, how do we evaluate a potential habitat? And this is Waquite Bay. Many of you who've been, probably everyone here who's gone to the seagrass talk have seen Joe Costa's surveys of Waquite Bay or the change in Waquite Bay over time. And do we consider these other areas when we're setting an evaluation of the seagrass habitat? What do we count? This is all potential seagrass habitat. Same thing in the surveys in Buzzards Bay. And then Joe put together a potential habitat of seagrasses based strictly on physical criteria, depth, water clarity, and this has certainly been done in Chesapeake Bay. And this may be an approach to take sort of along the lines of the essential fish habitat approach, which is being used where you look for areas that the species is at least potentially could occur and consider those as part of potential habitat. This is the hypothetical distribution of seagrass based on depth contours. So some of the issues raised about eelgrass habitat delineations and incompleteness, we've talked about this, the mapping, that the aerial mapping doesn't necessarily always define the deep end, perhaps missing some of the smaller patches, and might miss some really very, very well dispersed eelgrass beds. Eelgrass beds are dynamic, so they are changing, even if humans don't screw things up, which we frequently do. There's a certain amount of dynamism in those beds. Defining potential habitats for seagrass is something that needs more sort of thought, and then the need for more regular surveys and more extensive ground truthing. I think that's probably not news to anybody around here. We'd all love to see that. Finally, conclusions. There can be variations in the functions of seagrass meadows within an estuary and between estuaries. These variations are hard to predict based on the landscape criteria, so that model of the island biogeography perhaps doesn't apply well, at least to the seagrass landscapes, where we're dealing with a lot of these patches are fairly small compared to an island, and the movement between patches may be easier in the marine environment than in land, certainly because you're moving between islands. And then regardless, all seagrass patches in New England, the big picture is large or small, have a habitat value far beyond that of unvegetated adjacent areas, which is sort of the conservation message. And the mosaic of a seagrass meadow includes vegetated and unvegetated areas that interact and support other species. I think that's it. Thank you.